Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When I was 6 years old, my mum became pregnant with my sister, and I was left on my own quite a bit with a family member while she was going to antenatal classes with another family member. And it was during that time that I unfortunately became victim to many years of childhood sexual abuse. When this came out, he was the only person who I actually saw any emotion from. He actually went and smashed his grave to pieces. He actually said to me that if he had been alive, he would have killed him with his own hands and he would have happily gone to prison for it.
Gambling addiction was the worst part of your life, when you've just talked about the horrendous childhood that you went through.
It just spiralled out of control, Raphael. Like, at my worst, I was spending £1,000 a week. I then couldn't afford to pay my bills, so I had to have an IVA, which is an involuntary action agreement. It's like one step from bankruptcy, so I couldn't pay my bills. I didn't even see that as a negative. I actually saw it as a positive, because I thought, I'm able to get rid of all this debt, have a low monthly payment, but I'm still earning money that I can still continue to gamble with. It's all about creating a luxurious space that keeps you there. When I set up this girl, it was on the back of me becoming ready to share my childhood story, and I almost became fascinated by, if this is my life and this is my story and I've been able to sort of hold face for so many years, there must be other women and men out there that are the same.
Welcome to the Second Chance podcast. I'm Raphael Rowe, your host. This podcast focuses on the theme of second chance, exploring who deserves it, who has the authority to grant it, and what it means. We speak with people from diverse backgrounds, including those who have been given second chances and those who, some might argue, don't deserve them. Bianca Colclough, the founder of This Girl Community, has opened up about her own struggles with gambling addiction. Despite being unknown to many close to her, this addiction stemmed from years of sexual abuse by a family member and dealing with her parents' difficult divorce. She has also experienced her own divorce and 2 miscarriages. In an effort to help other women share their own stories and overcome their traumas, Bianca now brings women together to build self-worth and businesses step by step. Her company offers consulting and networking to support wellness and development. Bianca's gambling problems started small and quickly became unmanageable as she sought to escape her own reality. Her hope is that by sharing her story, others will be inspired to come forward and seek help in overcoming their own addictions. No matter what the addiction may be, whether it's related to alcohol, food, drugs, sex, cleanliness, or gambling, asking for help is a courageous step towards healing. Remember that you are not alone on this journey, and there is great strength in seeking support. I'm going to jump straight in because I know time is of essence for everyone these days. I wanted to start because I'd read and seen stuff on your website that, you know, today you're an empowered woman who is empowering other women in their chosen field, and you have an organisation that, you know, networks for women to take responsibility or empower themselves, etc., which is something I hope you will talk about later on. But in order to get to that place, I know that you've been on quite a challenging journey to reach that point of success where you are today. You've been on quite a challenging journey. So let me take you back to your childhood, which is, from what I understand, was the beginning of some traumas in your life that you had to deal with on this journey. Where did you grow up, and what was life like for you as a young girl?
So, happy, normal upbringing, really. I've been brought up all my life in Stoke-on-Trent, Staffordshire. Mum and Dad had me very young. I think my mum was only 17 when she had me. So, fairly normal upbringing, Raphael, really. Nothing particularly out of the ordinary. No real history of anything in our family that would have sort of posed any risk or potential worry for what was to come, I guess.
And what made up your family? Was it just you and your parents?
So there was myself and then my sister, who's younger than me. She didn't come along until I was 7. There was just me and my mum and my dad.
And how would you describe yourself as a child? You say you had a normal childhood without any kind of problems up until a certain point, but what was you like as a young girl?
Very much a fantasist, so I've always loved sort of drawing, writing. I still do that today. I've never been one to play with dolls. I'm quite a tomboy and always have been. From a very young age, I've been somebody that would sort of create stories in my head and then reenact them in the garden and sort of play, in my own head. I would be a very happy-go-lucky child, really. And
it's hard, isn't it, when you have to think back to what your childhood was like? I find it really difficult having memories of my childhood. Some people can regurgitate, you know, moments in their childhood that have stuck in their mind, and we all have that, but some people are really good at reflecting on and recollecting their childhoods. You mentioned that, you know, everything was normal and no one was aware about what was to become. What became, Bianca?
When I was 6 years old, my mum became pregnant with my sister, and I was left on my own quite a bit with a family member while she was going to antenatal classes with another family member. And it was during that time that I unfortunately became victim to many years of sexual abuse, childhood sexual abuse. This started very innocently, as I've mentioned on my website, where I was playing a game where you put a marble in one hand or the other, and you have to guess which hand the marble was in. And this particular individual chose to use that game as a form of abusing me. And that's when it started, really, because the marble started to be hidden in certain other parts of my body. And unfortunately, that became what I didn't ever realise at the time would be what has unfortunately shaped most of my childhood. So that any happy memories I have were taken away from that moment forward.
And you were how old at the time?
I was 6.
And how long did this abuse go on for?
It went on until I was 12 years old, and that was only because he passed away. So I fear that would have carried on. Unfortunately, it wasn't just myself. It was two other family members who were children as well that became victim to him. But I was the eldest.
And this person who came into your life when you were so young and vulnerable was able to take advantage of you and other family members. I hesitate to say how is that allowed to happen, but how did it happen to the point where, as a young child, you were not able or were able to sort of bring this to the attention of your parents or other people around you who should have been and could have been protecting you?
Yeah, you know, this is a question I've asked myself as a woman so many times, Raphael, because it angers me to think in my own mind why I wasn't strong enough to say anything, because my personality now can't really understand that. The whole basis of the abuse was around money. So I would be seen to be rewarded by money for doing an act, whether that was something that unfortunately was happening to me. I also became victim to having to abuse the other people, and I was paid for that as well. I later realised just how bad this was. But when you're young and this is somebody that is a position of trust and you see them at family gatherings and everybody loves them, they are seen as a figurehead in society, you know, they work for a school. As a child, you just think that what is happening to you is normal. I never ever once in my head, and I stand by this, ever thought that what was happening to me was wrong. And I find that very difficult to be so honest and say that, but it's true. I never realised that what was happening to me was actually not right until I got older.
And that's normal, isn't it, I suppose, in those circumstances, or not in those circumstances, because as young children, we accept what adults are telling us is the right and the wrong thing. And if you are exposed to something in the home and it's private, you don't take that. So it's not on you. It never is on anybody to be aware of what is happening to you. You mentioned that this individual also encouraged you or made you do things to your other family members as well.
Yeah, this is something I've had extreme trauma with throughout my life that I've had to come to terms with, because one of them was male and the other one was female, and this is what's haunted me most throughout my life, where I guess as I've researched and I voluntarily spoke to the police when I had my counselling, because it actually made me feel that I had become a perpetrator. I realise obviously now as a child I was absolutely a victim, and you know that was completely confirmed by the police that I had done nothing wrong and I was completely coerced by this person, which doesn't make it any easier, if I can be honest, because I almost felt that I was complicit in something, but I absolutely know I wasn't. I was a victim, and it was something that I was forced to do as a young child. I didn't realise that what I was doing was wrong, probably because the other two never said anything either. So, you know, it was the three of us all experiencing the same thing, but nobody ever actually told anybody what was happening.
I really appreciate your honesty and your candidness around what happened, because I can imagine it's not for anybody an easy thing to talk about, even many years down the line when you have become a stronger person and recognise and understand, whether it's through counselling or other means, the trauma that you went through. Can I ask, since those years, have you come together with the other two and had discussions or kind of, you know, played it out in order to understand the victims that you were?
With one of them, yes. With the male, I'm very close to him as a family member. We've sort of spoken about everything, and I feel that we've got healing between us because we've been able to share both our mutual journeys, but also things that had happened to him when I wasn't there, which I think for any male to have to experience that, you know, I accept my own trauma is horrific in its own sense, but from a male perspective, it really, really hurts me to see him struggling in a different way that I have. With the other person, no. It's something that breaks my heart, because I've never actually had that opportunity to sit down with them and talk to them about it, and it's caused a lot of fracture in our family. I don't have any contact with this person because they don't know how to come to terms with what's happened to them, and I guess they've used me as a fuel of fire to put blame on because the perpetrator's no longer alive, and that's something I really find difficult because I miss that person terribly.
And during this time, It's a difficult question because there's no real clear answer to it, but I suppose during this time when it was going on, and it went on for 6 years, where were your parents, where were your relatives' parents, where were other adults or people that might have been in a position, and this is important for others that are going through this experience or are unaware that they're going through this experience, not that children will be listening to this, but other people who might be able to recognise what was going on to you. So it's not a blame game. It's not putting blame on anybody for not being able to witness or being vigilant enough to spot what was going on to you and your relatives. But I do want to know if there is an answer to that question. You know, where were the adults around you and your relatives, and why were they not able to spot what you were suffering and going through?
This is probably something I'm never going to get the answer to, because I've tried to have this conversation with certain people, and some are shockingly defensive of the individual that did this and saying that they were ill and they were poorly and, you know, tried to defend it. I think that in another circumstance, because it was their father that was doing this, because he was a grandparent that did this to me, I don't think they can process it in their own head that this actually went on. And I think, looking back, I just feel that this person was so clever in coercing the control that he had over the three of us as children. My parents were young, Raphael. You know, I look back and they were out partying. You know, they were just young kids themselves. And, you know, I'm 42 now and I've only just had children. The thought of having a child when I was 17, I couldn't even begin to imagine. So I'm understanding from that perspective that, you know, suddenly I came along, my parents were kids themselves. So I think I suppose I just got put upon the grandparents, which most children do when, you know, they have young parents. And I guess, you know, they were just very clever at covering it up. And because I was never appearing sad or withdrawn, I'm guessing that's why nothing ever was picked up. I've tried to find this answer myself. And I don't know. Again, you know, it's the 80s as well. It was a whole different era where, I don't know, I hear so much now that so much was going on like this that has only really become uncovered in later generations.
And you mentioned that it came to an end when the individual died. So there is a closure, but also there's not a closure in terms of justice being done, because that perpetrator was not brought to justice in the sense that the criminal justice system is where people find some solace in somebody being punished for the wrong that they did against somebody else. How do you move on from that, Bianca, where you've never been through that process where the individual who did what they did to you is not just punished, but that there is recognition, because, as you just said, those adults around you have still not come to terms with what happened or are finding excuses to explain what happened, which in my book is wrong. But how do you move forward from this, knowing that there was never a kind of held to account moment?
So I don't know if there's any notoriety or anything in what I'm about to say, but I don't know if there's an element of Stockholm syndrome that I suffer with, because I never actually hated the person that did this to me until I was older, because I realised just the damage they'd done to me and how much they'd shaped the person that I'd become and some of my actions that I'll talk about shortly, you know, with the next part of my story. Where the hate came in and the justice for me was with my father. Me and my dad are really, really close. He's a typical guy from Stoke. You know, he loves the football, he loves the beer, he's tattooed, you know, he loves his heavy metal music. He's a bloke's bloke. And one of the things I don't think I've ever been able to get over is that my dad was never able to see justice for what happened to me and the other family members. When this came out, he was the only person who I actually saw any emotion from. He actually went and smashed his grave to pieces, and he actually said he wanted to dig him up, and literally, like, it was his way of coping with what had happened. And he actually said to me that if he had been alive, he would have killed him with his own hands, and he would have happily gone to prison for it, because it would have been his way of getting some justice, because the justice system doesn't do enough for predatory people like him. And I think he's lived his life, you know, him and I are very, very close. He has lived his life sort of with his own mental health issues of not being able to do anything to protect us. And that's the bit that saddens me the most, because I can kind of deal with it in my own head, but it's seen the ripple of destruction that this one person has caused in my family. I don't necessarily think that's focused enough on with people who've been victims of childhood sexual abuse. There is a focus on the individual, and there absolutely should be, but the ripple effect it has on breaking and fracturing families because of everybody's perceptions is far, far more worrying and mentally distressing to me than my own experience.
That's so interesting, and it's totally understandable how your father reacted, you know, in his ignorance, in the nicest possible way of not knowing what was going on, then to discover what was going on. And as you say, as a man's man, probably felt it struggled, as you say, with not being able to have protected you in the way that a father likes to protect his children or anybody that they feel that they can protect. How have you managed to move forward, build the bridges between, because without going into the details of who's who, but it sounds like it was so ingrained within your family that, as you say, it fractured your relationships and your father's relationships. How are you able to build those bridges, or have you allowed those bridges that have been broken to remain broken because you have no intention of mending what can't be mended, in the absence of the perpetrator, but also in the reaction of some of your relatives who have not really come to terms or accepted the suffering that you and your father and others have gone through?
I think I've sort of aligned myself to people as I've gotten older that I know I have my back and understand my journey. I've moved away from a number of family members because I don't see them adding any value in supporting me. They didn't want to support me back then, still don't want to support me now. I've never had an opportunity to sit down and ever tell my story to any member of my family. Not one person has ever actually sat me down and said, Bianca, will you tell me what happened? And I find that quite selfish because it was brushed under the carpet when I tried to tell my story as a child. And being a mother now myself, I understand the damage that brushing under the carpet has caused me as I've moved into my adult life and some of the very bad decisions and things that I've made throughout my life that have made me who I am today. Yeah, I just choose to remove myself now, but it isn't through lack of trying. You know, I don't have any relationship with my mother because of this, and I find that really sad. But I don't think she will accept and come to terms with the person that wants to tell her the story. She doesn't want to hear it, and I find that really strange that a mother wouldn't want to protect their child. But that's, you know, my dad is my mom and he's my dad, and, you know, he's somebody that I only focus my time on because he's the one person that has stood by me, but still hasn't heard my story. He doesn't want to listen. So it's very difficult to keep a lot of stuff in your head.
It must be really hard for those like your father who wants to do the most they can, but it's terrifying to think that at the point that you were most vulnerable, they were not, he was unable to protect you. You talked about how that experience and what you went through shaped the person that you went on to become. What person did you go on to become, Bianca?
So through my teens and sort of into my early 20s, I realised that I had become sort of almost multiplicity in my personalities. I was finding that I was quite sexualised, and a lot of the behaviour that I portrayed, I was sort of creating an image of myself that is what I believed men wanted to see. So, you know, I was heavily made up and I was wearing low-cut tops and sort of presenting myself in a very different way to how I felt in my own self. I actually worked as an exotic dancer for a number of years because I felt there was an element of control that I had over men because I was taking money from them and they weren't giving. And again, I realised now that all of this comes back to my childhood trauma, that I didn't have an understanding of money and men and sexualised behaviour. It's a common trait for women that have gone through childhood abuse. It was almost like I felt a power to do that. And yeah, that was quite a strange period in my life. What's very odd is that I actually had a very successful career throughout my life, and I kind of broke the mould of what an abuse survivor typical patterns they would go along. I actually held a successful career. I was able to hold relationships, you know, where a lot of people can't. I was told I couldn't have children by a family member from a very young age. I guess it's because they kind of knew what was going on to me. So I believed up until I was in my late 30s that I couldn't have children. So the shock I felt when I actually got pregnant was a shock. But it's all of those stigmatized beliefs that had come into my life growing up that had sort of shaped this person that I'd become. That working in sales, I believed that in order to get a sale, you had to wear the highest heels and the shortest skirt. And it was just a very bizarre period in my life where I realised now, as I reflect back on what I always class as my former self, that it was all because of what I'd experienced in my trauma. Everything lay back to that. Every part of my personality, everything that I'd become, the secrecy and the way I live my life, which leads on to sort of to the next chapter that I've never shared before that I'm choosing this platform today to talk about. So in 2009, I was on a night out with a friend, and I went to the night, the end of the night had finished, and he said to me, shall we go to the casino, because it's open till 4 a.m. And I said, yeah, go on then, we'll go. I've never been in one in my whole life. And I sat next to him, and he put £20 in this machine, and he won £50. And I thought, okay, that seems good. Like, how has he just won that money from pressing a couple of buttons? That was the beginning of the worst part of my life, because money came into play again, and I developed a terrible, terrible gambling addiction, which I now realise is because, again, of my relationship with money. And that's what I wanted to use this platform, Raphael, to share today, because there are very, very few women in this country that speak about addiction related to gambling, and especially people like me. So if I'm okay to do so, I'd love to share a bit about that journey as well, and sort of what that's meant for me in my life in the last sort of 12 years
Well, absolutely. I mean, thank you for taking this opportunity and wanting to share that part of your life. It shocks me that you feel the gambling addiction was the worst part of your life when you've just talked about the horrendous childhood that you went through and the challenges that's thrown in front of you with your relationships with your family. But as you say, you know, that then drove the character that you become in terms of the work that you did and the life. But before you go into the details about gambling, I just want to roll back on the point that you made there, because as I was listening to you, I was thinking, given it shaped your character, not the child abuse, but the person that you become, you know, you took control of yourself, even though it was driven by money to some extent and this kind of way you'd characterized yourself. Did you see it, Bianca, as a negative or a positive? Because was you building your character and the strength that has made you the woman that you are today? Because people reflect on their past experiences and that can shape the person that they are, even if those past experiences have been so negative and, as you say, would rightly traumatize people to end up becoming, you know, drug dependent because they want to, you know, drown their sorrows or alcohol. But would you say that in those teenage years and your young adulthood, that it was a negative or a positive experience, even though some of what you may have done was negative?
I actually say positive, Raphael, and I speak of this a lot. You know, I feel that when people talk about some of the things I just have, there should be an element of me feeling ashamed. I actually felt really empowered. I felt that in the career I was working in sales and being very successful at what I was doing, I was actually taking control of my life, and I felt I'd lost some control over the decisions that were almost made for me as a child. I felt that I was entering this period of my life where I was in control of who I was, what I wanted to do. I felt I was in control when I was selling in the industry I was working in. You know, I was very good at my job, and that ended up sort of being a lot of what marked me from a mentorship perspective and a career perspective. I feel that those skills I gained. I think what I do find negative from a reflection perspective is more so the secrecy element. And you know, it was the fact that I was almost Bianca at home, who was this quiet person that loved dogs and loves reading and loves nature. Then I was this person that went to work, that got dressed up, you know, and went out to work in recruitment, and I was great at what I did. But then I was also this other person that was hiding this really dark past that I'd almost shut away somewhere in my head, and never thought it was going to surface. And that's my naivety that I now reflect back on, that I wish I could have just told my younger self that this needs to be dealt with. I just think that I just thought, okay, I've experienced this abuse when I was young. That's okay now, it's done. I'm happy now and I never have to think about it. Couldn't have been more wrong. And that's strongly why I believe the addiction came into play, because it was my whole psyche of trying to sort of understand what was going on in my head that led me down the path that it did in 2009.
But that's obvious, isn't it? Because when, like you say, you're trying to hide a secret, you take on a different persona and you're dressing up and going to work and pretending to be another Bianca. Although it was Bianca, you know, the clothes don't change the feelings and the, you know, it might change your appearance, but it doesn't change the pain or the emotions that you felt, positive or negatively. So I get that. You want to share the struggle you had with addiction, and it all started when you went along to this casino. Talk me through that story.
So this particular night, as I mentioned, so I just literally watched my friend put some money in a machine. I never realised at the time that he was actually an addict, because, you know, gambling, as with any addiction, people don't really speak about it. What I think makes gambling such a dangerous addiction is that it's silent. And that's something, you know, I've actively learned as I've gone through my trauma of this particular part of my journey. The next day I went to that casino again. And as with most addicts, how they start in the gambling world is, of course, I won. You know, it's so, if I'd have lost, you know, it's the same story. Maybe I wouldn't have gone back and back and back, but I won. And I just found the place, a casino, for anybody that's ever been in, is somewhere that typically has no windows, or it's very sort of dark in there. So there's no understanding of what time it is. You completely lose sense of where you are. You have people that are trained to get to know you, look after you, make you feel special, bring you drinks, but then remember what drink you want the next time you come in. You get free food. It's all about creating a luxurious space that keeps you there. I love that, because I didn't really ever feel like there was any part of my life where I felt belonging. So when I was sat in the casino, there was this community of people, mainly women, at the slot machines. And I just felt safe there. I felt that I could just shut myself off from the world, sit at this machine, feeding money into it with absolutely no concept of what was actually what I was doing from a rational perspective. But I was overtaken by this feeling of solace and serenity that I just felt really calm. That was the dangerous side of it for me, because I actually had the money to spend at that time. So my rationale behind my gambling was, I had friends that would think nothing of going into a big department store and spending £1,000 on a handbag. Why are they not persecuted, but I would be persecuted for spending £1,000 in a casino? And that was my rationale for it. And I would openly say this to people, and I did all through my addiction. Where I guess it became worse is that I started working from home. So I took a role in the same industry where I was working from home. And I actually had two laptops. So I needed to be at home because I had to take calls and interview people. But for the 8 hours I was doing my job, I would have my other laptop open with a gambling site, and it would just be constantly on all day, spinning, spinning, spinning all day. And that would be my life. I'd be working and I'd have an online casino next to me. It just spiraled out of control, Raphael. Like, at my worst, I was spending £1,000 a week on, you know, literally any penny I had. I sold everything that I owned, and I also sold things that my now ex-husband owned that he didn't know about, which shames me, because I was just that desperate to find money. I then couldn't afford to pay my bills, so I had to have an IVA, which is an involuntary action agreement. It's like one step from bankruptcy, so I couldn't pay my bills. I didn't even see that as a negative. I actually saw it as a positive, because I thought, I'm able to get rid of all this debt, have a low monthly payment, but I'm still earning money that I can still continue to gamble with. At the helm of it being its worst, I was sort of travelling to different casinos across sort of Manchester, Stoke, Birmingham, just so that they didn't keep wondering why I was in there all the time. I would lie about where I was going. So I would say, I'm going out with friends, but I wouldn't be spending any time with my friends because every waking second I could, I'd be sat in the casino. And I just loved it there. I couldn't find in my head any reasoning why I shouldn't be doing it. And this is what the horrible, horrible thing of addiction is. And I use the analogy, for me, gambling addiction is glamorized so much. You know, you can watch anything on the TV, football sponsors, TV programs, daytime TV is sponsored by gambling. They're not sponsored by alcohol, they're not sponsored by cigarettes because, you know, those things are not deemed as societally accepted. But you can turn on the TV now and I'll guarantee something will be sponsored by a gambling site. It's so glamorized. Again, sorry, I was saying, I use the analogy, if I sat in a casino for 8 hours a day, and then at the end of that day, I've just lost £1,000, I would have to get in my car, go home, and cook dinner, sit on the settee, talk to my partner about his day, and he would never ever know about this addiction. If you sat and put a needle in your arm for 8 hours straight, or drank vodka for 8 hours straight, you'd be dead. That's how serious a gambling addiction is, and I don't genuinely feel that it is taken as seriously because it's a silent addiction. Just because I'm not physically putting something in my body, the effects were the same. So my mental health just blew up because there was days when I would be at home and it would be like 3 o'clock in the morning and I knew I couldn't even afford to live. I couldn't afford to put petrol in my car. And I'd be sat on my phone getting payday loans out, payday loans after payday loans, just so that I could live. And it's awful. It's awful to think that I lived that way.
The analogy that you used about, you know, 8 hours of alcohol or injecting yourself with a drug like heroin for 8 hours, that the physical consequences would be obvious to anyone that you have that addiction and they may seek to help you. But you're right in that gambling is this secrecy. It's kind of something you can do quietly without people knowing. But given the depth to which you became addicted to gambling, and you mentioned your husband, so you were married at the time, how were you able to hide that behavior from someone? How do people who are addicted to gambling, how was you able to hide the reality of the amount of money you were spending, the debt that was spiraling, given that you were in a married relationship at the time and in those relationships you're supposed to be sharing everything and be aware of everything? How was you able to hide it? Or was they aware of it but didn't recognise how serious the problem had become?
Yeah, and this is a really good point. This is something I'd actually noted that I wanted to talk about. So he was aware that I gambled, but I think it was more recreational. I don't think he or anybody, you know, still to this day had any clue of how bad it was. I almost found that it became quite like a joke thing. So like I'd go out with friends and they'd be like, oh, are we going to the casino? Am I going to sit at the casino with you now for 4 hours? And like my friend would fall asleep next to me and just, I'd be sat there until 4, 6 o'clock in the morning just gambling. And I think it became very easy to sort of make a joke of it because I wasn't ever physically in pain or I guess, you know, when I mentioned earlier this being a product of my childhood, my brain had been trained from a very young age to keep secrets very, very well. You know, I'm conditioned to hide things. I'm conditioned to be comfortable in not sharing. And that's a lot of self-development work I've done on myself, which sort of is why I created the business I have, because I got fed up of hiding who I really was. And I was ashamed internally, but angered that I'd become a victim again to an addiction that had almost become my perpetrator again, because it was making me keep a secret. It was making me feel ashamed. It was making me lie. And these are all traits that I now psychologically relate back to my childhood. It isn't until you step away from that you realise how bad. I'll give you an example. So I would be sat in a casino And you're always going to win. It's always your next go. You know, if I just put in £20 more, I'm going to win. I'm going to get a feature which would give me free spins. That means I might win a jackpot. It's ridiculous. And I remember sitting in the casino one day and I'd got no money, literally not a penny in my bank. I'd wiped out the joint account as well. I'd taken money out of the joint account. And I rang my dad and I told him I'd got a flat tire. And I went outside at the casino, so it was noisy in the background, so it sounded like I was stood at the side of the road. And I said, "Dad, I've got a flat tyre. Can you send me some money? I've got a guy on the way to do my tyre. Can you send me £200? Then he sent me £200. It was not for the tyre. I just went straight back into the casino and used the money there. And that was a regular thing. I would say anything to anybody to try and get money so that I could gamble. And that disgusts me because that is not who I am. That is not what I stand for and what I believe in. But you are in a trance. That gambling just takes you in a different zone completely. And you always think you're going to win. And in my head, I was going to get that money off my dad. And then I was going to go in the casino and I was going to win. And I was going to wire it straight back to him. Of course I didn't.
What's interesting, Bianca, people listening to this may be on that spiral themselves right now, where they are going to casinos or other facilities that allow them to use slot machines or gamble in some way. And they're not recognising what you now know. You didn't recognise at the time. This idea of, you know, another £20, I'll win the jackpot, but it never came. I'm sure there were many occasions where you did win, maybe not anywhere near as much as you were spending, because that's the trick of the casinos, and I don't understand it. I'm not a gambler. I never use casinos. But what is that flip moment? If you were talking to other people or people that are listening to this are thinking, am I on the verge of becoming what Bianca became? Addicted to slot machines and gambling and spending everything I own and what others are giving to me. What is it that you've learned now that you think people need to understand?
This is something I am actively going to be spending the next sort of year and two sort of creating as part of my business, because I think it's hugely underrepresented for women. And I think the male gambling market is represented very well, I think, to support men with addiction, because it's always linked back to sport bet. There's a lot of stigma in gambling that it's men, because they place bets, they, you know, football bets, right back to the pools back in the day when someone would come round to me and my dad's house, you know, to place a bet on the horses and the football and stuff. Where I think there's a huge stigma, Raphael, is I don't think women in today's society feel that it's acceptable to talk about it, because it's quite embarrassing. But it's astonishing just how many women are victim of gambling addiction, because it's so easy and accessible to do on your phone, on your laptop, whilst you're working, like I did, to go into the casino and feel part of a community. Where I found myself moving away from that is I don't know what it was, because it wasn't about the money. I just stopped enjoying it. I think that the transition I've gone through in my life over the last few years, I no longer feel I need that release. I have my release with my children, my partner. I love my life now, you know, and that is, I think, for me, a sure way of me looking that every single person that I used to sit around in that casino, which were the same faces all the time, we knew everybody in there, but you would never speak to them outside of the casino. It was like you knew everybody by name, but if you pass them in a supermarket, you don't speak to them. It's like this hidden underworld. I now realise just how sad they must be in themselves, and that there must be something they're harbouring. And I would love to use my voice to help other women to say, you know, look, it's not embarrassing. There's nothing to be ashamed of. Just because it's not a physical addiction, you don't need to be in the shadows. You can talk about this. And I want to normalise that behaviour. I appreciate the great work that's being done with the bigger commissions, your Senses, your GAM Cares. They're great, but they're not for real women like me. There's something that, to me, am I going to ring an 0800 number and start speaking to a stranger about my gambling addiction? Yeah, I might do, but I'll be straight back in the casino tomorrow. I need a real conversation with someone that's talking to me about lived experience, some of the things I've shared, and for them to know that, you know, I'm not in a gutter somewhere. I'm still living a life, you know, and I'm a normal person. I'm not this dirty person that's coming out of rehab who's been addicted to something, and you know, I'm a mess. I'm just a normal functioning woman that's just gone through a bit of a shitty time, and life's thrown a few curveballs at me. But I want to show women that this is not to be. It needs to stop being glamorized. It really does, and I need people to know that they can physically show the emotion that comes with a gambling addiction.
And you talked and skirted over quite quickly how you reached the point where enough was enough, you weren't enjoying it anymore. But given the depth at which you'd sunk in terms of your gambling addiction, what would you say was the pivotal moment? What is the message that you want women who are in the same predicament as you was? What do they need to know? Because there was something, there must have been something that made you decide enough was enough. And it wasn't because your bank account was empty, because you found other ways to get money to continue your addiction. You'd been sat beside these people that you started to dislike or didn't want to be like for a long period of time. So what would you say was that moment that other people might be able to latch on to and find a different direction? Was it, you know, falling in love with someone, developing a relationship, knowing that you wanted to become a mother? Was there anything significant that took you on a different trajectory?
Yeah, so probably a blend of each of those things. So my partner is my best friend. You know, I'm in a very good place in my life now, and I felt that I no longer wanted to hide or lie to him. We're very, very transparent. He knows all of my history, my story, everything. I respect him too much to want to lie to him, and I have never had that in my life before. I've never felt that security and love from somebody enough to want to do right by them, and I've always felt like everybody was against me and I didn't really care what partners thought of me because I didn't really treat them very well. With my partner now, I really, really respect him. Becoming a parent, my God, that has changed my life. I never thought I was going to be, once I became a mum in 2021, I had a little boy, and then the year after I had a little girl. So
congratulations.
I've been pregnant twice in 2 years, which is amazing. And the thought of sitting in a casino for 8 hours and missing any opportunity to see their beautiful faces, which sounds really cheesy and corny, nothing was worth that. You know, I've waited until my 40s to become a mum, never thinking I could be one. I am not going to sit and waste a penny of my money that I could be spending on my family and enjoying memories with them, putting it into a machine. And I developed a hatred for where I was. I started to resent going in there. I would have this attitude, well, I've got £300 to spend. If I lose £300, it doesn't matter because I never expected to win anyway. That £300 suddenly had value to me. It was not just a piece of paper. It was actually money that I could invest in my business. It was money that I could spend with my family. And yeah, I think having my business has completely transformed my mindset with money as well. So I value money so much more now. And I would say, for anybody that's going through this journey, there's too many cliches, Raphael. You know, people will say things like, go to rehab, pick up the phone and speak to somebody, ban yourself. It's not that easy. You know, it's not, yeah, I'll just go to the reception desk and ban myself. But guess what? The guy on reception has known me for 10, 15 years. Hi, Bianca, how are you? Oh, I'll do it next time. And I'll just go back out to my car. It's not as easy as that. So I'm a realist. And I think there's so much out there that sort of gives advice on what people need to do to stop gambling. They need to speak to somebody that's living that experience. And the textbook answers don't work. You know, I banned myself from a casino locally. And when I did this, this is word for word, the lady said, your ban's up in 6 months, Bianca, so we'll see you then. Now, where's the duty of care in that situation for somebody who clearly must know I have an addiction, but their way of advocating that is saying, we'll see you in 6 months. They make me a platinum card holder, which means I get anything that I ever could want when I go in there. It's all a nurturing and a grooming process to keep you in there. And it's just wrong. Something needs to change in the industry. It really does.
Just one last question on that. What would you say you spent as opposed to what you won during the time that you were addicted, and how long did that addiction last?
I would have months when I lost loads of money, and then I would have a month when I'd have loads. Like, there was a month, like not last year, the year before, when I put about £10,000 into my bank, which is great, and obviously you celebrate those wins, but you don't think of the £1,000 a week that you'd lost during all the... But gamblers don't think that way. They only think about their last win. And what you also don't think about is the fact that the majority of that 10 grand probably went back in again. Because the hit, the high that you get when you win, you think, wow, I'll go on, I want that again. And that's the horrible cycle that you can get yourself into. So... overall, obviously, I must be severely down, because I would never have had to have taken out an IVA and not be able to pay my bills. But there were some months when I had what I used to call dirty money in my bank. This money was never there for long. It was dirty money. So I would either gamble it back away, or I'd have to spend it quickly, book a holiday, spend it on my family, because it was guilt money for me. So, you know, it was like the money that shouldn't be there. So I do say, with a gambling addiction, in a lot of cases, it's not about the money. It was never about the money for me. It was about the feeling of serenity and calm when I was in there, that I could just sit and not speak to anybody from 8 hours. It was like an escapism.
Well, look, I wish you well on that quest to make, you know, gambling companies, casinos and other organisations more aware of the problems that women face who become addicted to slot machines. And it sounds like that quest can be successful, given that there is not enough attention being given in that direction. And it also sounds like, you know, the roller coaster of a life that you've had up until now has had its highs as well as its lows. But you now have a consultancy business which is driven to empower women, or at least create a space where women who take on a persona that's not really them — this is what I read, but you can, you know, give me more details — but it felt like it was one of those organisations that, as you said, you put on the high heels because you thought it was your sexuality that would get the deal, rather than, or in addition to your skills to argue or present or sell something. Tell me a little bit about the business that has come out of everything, that the journey that you've been on today. And I think it's called the Girl Consultancy, right?
Yeah, This Girl. Yeah,
This Girl Consultancy. Yeah.
So when I set up This Girl, it was on the back of me becoming ready to share my childhood story. And I almost became fascinated by, if this is my life and this is my story, and I've been able to sort of hold face for so many years, there must be other women and men out there that are the same. And I almost became fascinated by this psychological journey of wanting to find other women that had a story. So when I created my strapline, "This Girl Has a Story, Let's Start With Yours," I just simply reached out to women and I asked them to tell me a little bit about themselves and what had shaped who they've become today. And I've never met, in the 3.5 years I've run the business, I've never met anybody that doesn't have a story. Every single person I meet has a story. And everybody kind of says the same things about their journeys, albeit their stories are completely different. We all kind of come together with a single meaning, that as time has gone by and as we've matured in age and mindset and not giving a damn so much about what people think of us, our voice becomes our superpower. And that is what This Girl is for me. I'm not ashamed of my past. I don't want to be defined by my past. But I want other women to come on this journey with me and know that if you need help, you don't have to just go to your GP and be handed antidepressants. There are other ways. And in those other ways is finding women who have found their voice, as I have, in various different avenues, whether it's domestic violence, whether it's grief, whether it's parenting, and allowing those women to share their story and allow other women to come forward, whether it's to listen, to share, to write, if they don't want to use their voice. You know, we get a lot of ladies that write a letter, their story through a creative story that way. And my whole business was just built out of a social project, really. I just sort of put this out during lockdown to see whether anybody else would be as open as I would. And we're now a successful business that runs a membership platform for women to support their personal and professional wellness. We have a consultancy business, so we work with a number of different businesses who, let's say, their idea of well-being might be putting a bowl of fruit at the end of the desk, you know. So my mindset is, like, let's have a real talk here about what's going on in a business. We're not asking you to change the world, but we're asking you to listen. I guess that's what I didn't have. So my mission now is to work with businesses, use my voice, but have this amazing tribe of women around me that can help other people share their stories without judgment, because I think women still fear judgment. We don't want to be judged. We fear that we have to filter ourselves, which is why social media is such a toxic place. I just want to be unapologetically myself now. And if people don't like that or don't want to hear my story, I don't care, because I've had to keep that story to myself for so long. And if it upsets family members, if it upsets people, there will be people it doesn't upset and that it helps. And they're the people I'm interested in.
It's so interesting because I see it, I frame a lot of the work that I do in a similar vein, you know, just hearing people's stories in the hope that, or people sharing their stories on platforms like this, my podcast, will inspire, motivate other people. I wonder, and you tell me this because you're speaking to lots of women who have empowered themselves, I wonder how much age is a factor, you know, age and wisdom, you know, it feels to me as I've listened to you that there were certain points of your life where you were not in control of it in the way that you could have been in control of it, like you know now. But that comes with wisdom, right, and age. And I suppose during that journey, you've reached a point in your life, and women and men at a certain age reach a point in their life where they can be more empowered to be the person that they've always been, but now they can show, or they're not wanting or don't care about people judging who they are, what they look like, what they do. And that comes with age, whereas lots of young women are still being influenced by social media, as are young men. And do you find that in the networks that your business is working with, that the women who have reached that point where they can embrace who they are and be who they want to be, given the challenges that women face in the workforce in previous years, do you find that that's one of the biggest factors? Age, wisdom?
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely. I think my youngest member's like 28, you know, and that's something I actively want to change. I would love to get a younger demographic of audience into the business. But you're exactly right. I think societal pressure, stigma on what the younger generation should be like. I guess a relatability to somebody like myself, talking about who I am now, it's important that I talk about the person I was when I was younger, when I didn't know who I was, and some of the, you know, social media wasn't around it like it is today. You know, there was no Facebook or anything in the 80s and 90s. But in me sharing those experiences that I had without social media, I was still almost filtering myself, but without it being in the digital era. And if I can bridge that gap in allowing young women to come forward and talk about their story from a younger age, maybe it wouldn't have taken me until my late 30s to share my story. And I think if I, in doing the small bit of work I am with this girl and allowing to create this space where younger girls can come and feel they're safe, they're not judged, and talk about things, you know, that they've witnessed through their upbringing or experienced through their upbringing, that paves the way for the generations of my children and how their minds are shaped to be more open. It'd be great to live in a world where we didn't even have these stories, but unfortunately we do.
Absolutely, so. We do. What does Second Chance mean to you?
Second Chance for me is me allowing myself to be me. And I think we've just touched upon this. I think I've lived my life as somebody else with a zip over my mouth for so long. And my second chance for me now is that I am going to use my voice as my superpower, and I am going to get my voice heard. I don't want to be silenced anymore. I'm not ashamed of anything I've shared. If I can continue to do that into my 40s, 50s and beyond, I'm on a mission led business now, and I'm not here to make money as such. I'd like to, I've got bills to pay, but for me it's about creating something that's a legacy. That's what my mission is. So that second chance for me is this girl. It was a chance for me to step away from the career I had and know that I can use what has been a horrible, horrible experience in my life for good.
It's so interesting because when I reflect on what we've talked about today and the challenges that you've overcome, that there are a number of areas, isn't there, in your life, whether it's the child abuse, whether it's the addiction, the persona that you created for yourself. How do you juggle that? I mean, notwithstanding you're a mum with young kids, that you've got to also nappy change and do all those things that require a lot of attention every day, even with a partner, and you share that. I mean, how do you do that? I just wonder how you do that, how you find the space to juggle all the things that you need to juggle as a woman in this day and age.
Yeah, I actually got asked that yesterday by a lady who was on one of my networking sessions. I was referred to as an Amazon warrior princess.
Great name.
That's great. I'll take that. My coping mechanism, Raphael, is to be busy. I find that I'm not yet at a space with my own mental headspace that I can sit and be fully happy. I'm still on that journey, and I don't think I'll ever be clear of my experiences, and I almost don't want to be because they're part of who I am. Being busy for me is my coping mechanism, and I enjoy pressure. Sometimes when I don't have anything in my diary and I am quiet, that would have been the time that I would have had my what I call my tics to want to get in my car and go to the casino. So I'm learning now how to fill my time with more wellness-based things, so doing yoga, meditation more, spending time planning on my business. I do struggle a little still with that time, and I think that from a gambling addiction perspective is definitely something I will touch point on when I move forward with my project that I'm going to be working through, is to help women to keep busy. As much as people see that as how do you juggle everything, it actually is what is my coping mechanism.
And you talked earlier about counselling, that you had counselling. How helpful did you find that, and are you still having counselling, and how important is that to help men and women overcome some of the challenges that they face?
So I put myself onto a counselling programme for my trauma when I was 37, and I found it useful to an extent. I felt that I had to filter myself considerably because of it was lockdown at the time, and it was it was just about the period when lockdown came, so I was supposed to have had face-to-face sessions and they became online. One of the biggest challenges I found with the counselling is that the other ladies that were on the session with me were all in a very different headspace to me. So there were ladies that like hadn't got out of bed in 10 years. There was ladies that were coming onto the sessions, they were drug dependent. I was coming across like I was fine, because I was leading a relatively normal life, and I found that really challenging because I felt like I was being judged, that actually my story wasn't as serious as the others because they physically looked different. So personally, I don't think it really helped me. I found my own self-development and my own journey more empowering than going through a clinical route. Maybe that was always in the back of my mind with this girl, though, because in order for me to create that non-clinical space and give women the chance to just talk, is something I never had.
And I suppose that's that's another interesting point, because counselling will work for some people. You mentioned people not getting out of bed for 10 years; they might need that. It sounds like your strength of character came from your experiences. You've turned all those negatives into a positive one because you've embraced them. And I am a strong believer that if you embrace the negatives in your life and use it to better yourself, your understanding, your learning, your projection of what you want to do next, it stands you in a good position. I think when you try and hide those things, then it becomes a weight around you're being able to take a step forward. Bianca, thank you so much for being so open and candid about your life's journey. And I hope that people listening to this can be inspired by the challenges you've overcome and the direction you've taken your life in, and the honesty with which you share your story, especially, being prepared to share with my listeners your gambling addiction and your recognition that it is a problem for more women than society itself wants to recognize, and all power to you for wanting to go out there and make people aware, more aware of that problem, and empower other people, women, to come forward and talk about that problem so more can be done to recognize it and address that problem. Is there anything you want to say before we bring this to a close?
No, I just want to say thank you, because I've never told that chapter. I call it chapter two for some reason. Chapter two is the gambling side. Chapter one was the childhood side. And I think anybody sharing a story that is relevant in their adult life, there's a huge amount of bravery in that, as much as there is with people sharing their childhood. It's the here and now that I'm still working on. And that part of that is something that's going to be a continual development. And I think for people to reach out to me if they want to talk about that confidentially, I absolutely would love to hear it. And from a selfish perspective, for my own ongoing therapy as well, because I found my This Girl journey so enlightening by actually listening to other women and knowing that you're not alone. So thank you for allowing me to share this story on your platform. I appreciate it.
And just on this girl, if women listening to this, young and old, I say old, young and middle-aged and old, if they do want to get involved, how can they kind of reach out to you if they've got a story they want to share, or just connect and network with the women in your network so they can learn or inspire and motivate others? What should they do?
Thank you. They can go onto my website, which is thisgirlcommunity.com. And I am also on Instagram as well, at This Girl Community. There's lots of inspiring stories about the ladies in our network. They can join any of our sessions and book onto any of them via the website. And yeah, if they wanted to reach out, they can click on the Contact Us page and that'll come straight through to myself as well.
And as I say that, I'm also thinking there's lots of male listeners. Are men excluded from the girl network?
No. So we don't exclude men from This Girl. What we do say is that we're very active in wanting to support men who have any challenges with females in their life that they want to talk about. So we don't directly help the mental health of men per se, but I do work with an amazing company that help that side of it. But if you're a male and you have challenges with any female in your family, your partner, etc., then absolutely, you know, come along and we'll be more than happy to talk to you and share our wisdom.
And I'm smiling at this point because I can imagine your phones are going to be inundated or messages from men sort of saying, oh well, there's this woman in my life who I etc etc. Bianca, thank you so much for joining me and sharing your story today.
Pleasure. Thank you so much. Cheers. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to Second Chance Podcast. Your support is greatly appreciated. You can find the video of this interview on our YouTube channel at Second Chance Podcast, where you can also subscribe to be notified of new episodes. Please share our episodes with your friends, your family and colleagues, and follow us on YouTube and your preferred podcast platform for updates on new episodes. Your feedback is also crucial to the growth of our podcast, so please rate and review our episodes and let us know your thoughts in the comments section. We rely on several talented individuals and teams to bring this podcast to life. Sophie Warner, Lewis Hunt and Logan Martin assist create our content. Audio Avalanche handles audio editing. J-Row Productions creates original music. Studio Minerva designs our eye-catching covers. Social media marketing agency Scribble manages and creates our social media content. Kim Collicutt oversees episode production with me, your host, Raphael Rowe. Thanks for tuning in.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too.
That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.